by the way, our coverage tonight, when you might be watching the Yankees-Red Sox debate, our coverage of tonight's Kerry-Bush debate begins at 8 o'clock. I'll be hosting an hour of pre-debate coverage, and then, of course, we'll have it live on AM 820. We'll hold the Lexus commercials. We will talk now to C.K. Prahalad, the best-selling author and business consultant, about why he thinks businesses should be marketing more to the 4 billion people on Earth who earn less than $2 a day. He thinks that would be better than a lot of traditional relief programs to help lift people out of poverty in developing nations, and he thinks businesses stand to reap windfall profits from gigantic untapped markets that they usually ignore. Is this symmetry in asymmetry too good to be true? Let's ask C.K. Prahalad, professor of corporate strategy and international business at the University of Michigan Business School. He is best known for his international bestseller, Competing for the Future, and his 1998 article, The End of Corporate Imperialism. His new book is called The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, Eradicating Poverty Through Profits, Enabling Dignity and Choice Through Markets, published by the Wharton School Publishing Group. The book earned blurbs on the jacket from people ranging from Bill Gates to Madeleine Albright. Dr. Prahalad, a pleasure. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Is there really a fortune at the bottom of the pyramid?
Yes, I think let me start with what the basic premise is, and then we'll ask, is there a market at the bottom of the pyramid? The basic premise is very simple, and it is an apparent paradox. 80% of humanity has been below the radar screen of large companies. At the same time, large firms are struggling with the need for organic growth and innovation. All that I do is to connect the two. How can we create organic growth and source of innovations for large firms by exploring and creating markets at the bottom of the pyramid? This requires that we don't see the poor as victims and helpless people, but see them as resilient, persistent, and entrepreneurs in their own right. So if we can convert our thinking from poor as those who need subsidies to poor as potential consumers, I think we can see a market opportunity here.
But if I'm a CEO, and you're talking about marketing to people who make $2 a day.
That's right.
Why should I take that seriously? Where are the profits and the growth potential in that?
Let me give you clear examples. If you just take 10 countries, China, India, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, Turkey, Russia, South Africa, Philippines, and Malaysia, just these 10 countries represent 14 to $15 trillion in purchasing power GDP. It is in purchasing power dollars, not in U.S. dollars, but that is the nature of intensity of commerce on what dollars can buy in those countries.
And is that not concentrated in the, the few percent of those countries that hold most of the wealth?
No, actually not. I think if you look at the total pyramid, there's $14 trillion in these 10 countries. First, it makes it a bigger market than Germany, Italy, UK, France, and Japan put together. And the reason why this has so much strength is not that the few people at the top own all the wealth, but it is spread all across. People still buy food, they buy healthcare, they buy education. So there is a large amount of activity that is going on. More importantly, these markets are young, they're growing, they accept new technologies more readily, actually I would say even more readily than even the developed markets, and they're huge. So I think the market does exist. And the question for us is, how do you create at the bottom of the pyramid a capacity to consume? We just look at people and say, if you have $2 a day, you cannot be a market. But if you turn that around and say, if we can create the capacity to consume, we can create a market. So this is not about serving a market that currently exists.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me a concrete example of that? I know your book is full of examples and success stories. A concrete example of creating a market where none existed?
Yes, I will certainly do so. Take, for example, simple things that all of us take for granted. Shampoo. Or soap. Now, we tend to buy a large bottle of shampoo at $5 or $7 a bottle because we can use cash to inventory convenience. We do not want to go to the supermarket on a daily basis. So we use cash to inventory convenience because we have cash. If I'm a poor person working on $2 a day with uncertain incomes, I cannot use cash that way because I don't have it. On the other hand, if I can give single serve, that means enough shampoo for one use only, packaged in a simple sachet, I can afford to buy it at 1 cent. Actually, if you go to India and look at the market for shampoo, in terms of the total tonnage, it is as large and larger than the United States. But 97% of the units sold are sold in single-serve sachets. And 67% of the value of all that is sold in single-serve. And it is extremely profitable. It is Procter & Gamble, it's Unilever, primarily, and with some local companies which are doing this. The return on capital employed in this business is bigger and better than the returns that you get by serving the rich.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. My guest is C.K. Prahalad, the professor of corporate strategy and international business at the University of Michigan Business School and best-selling author. His new book is The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. Does U.S. government policy have a role to play here in encouraging the kind of thing you're talking about? Global poverty is not an issue in the presidential campaign, even though it probably should be. But does U.S. policy matter to your ideas?
Yes, I think U.S. policy does matter. And I think the most important part of the policy is how do we look at poor countries exporting their products to the United States. If you want to build global interdependence, and if you want to build the desire for middle-class existence across the world and therefore act as an antidote for terrorism, we should increasingly expect people to trade, to become interdependent, and therefore respect each other. I think we have talked a lot about open global markets and globalization for the last 10 years, but certainly we don't seem to like the implications of globalization because the pain will be asymmetric. Sometimes other countries will suffer unemployment. Sometimes we do, but we need to understand in the long term, U.S. policy can have a significant impact on the use of trade and business logic to both eradicate poverty and to make it a better world.
And as it happens, we'll be having a debate on free trade and outsourcing as an issue in the presidential campaign right after the news. But you described before how a company like Procter & Gamble might market, say, individual portions of shampoo to very poor people. So that might be an example of how a company might take advantage of markets among the very poor in developing nations that they're not seeing. But how does that actually help to lift those people out of poverty? So far, it sounds like it's just helping them to use some of their money to buy a certain company's shampoo.
Yeah,
what's the larger picture there?
The larger picture is how do you get people to understand that they can improve the quality of their lives? I just gave the example of shampoo. I can as easily turn to say, how do you get people to get access to micro savings and micro credit? If you look at a company like ICICI, which is the second largest bank in India, you find that they have the ability to work with self-help groups of 20 women in villages, train them to save, and train them to understand the law of contracts so that they can give them credit, put them in business, allow them to build their houses better, build a kitchen, build a bathroom, whatever they want to do.
We've been talking on the show for 15 years to people who think microcredit is a good idea, and everyone seems to be in agreement with that, no matter where they are on the political spectrum. Why isn't it now much more dramatically widespread?
I think the difference between microcredit that has been traditionally implemented and this one is it starts with micro savings. people have to learn to save before they understand the value of banking relationships.
Even on their $2 a day?
Yes. I think, for example, it's amazing for us that people are willing to save a dollar a week. And typically, this work is focused on women. It is amazing across the world, the work gets focused on women. If you start saving a dollar a week, and then you have 20 women, so $20 a week, and suddenly in 20 weeks, it's $400, because it's a large amount of money. And then they start lending their own saving among themselves, which means they do the work of monitoring projects, prioritizing projects. They start understanding how business works.
So it's going from a subsistence mindset to a growth mindset at the personal level.
Absolutely. And the entrepreneurial mindset. And very soon, what they're finding is that this is not a small experiment. This covers now almost touches a million people and 250,000 families, and it's growing rapidly. What they're finding is that, A, not only is this business profitable for the large company, but more importantly, the default rate is less than 0.25%. Let me repeat, less than 0.25%. People are responsible at that level. They understand that access to a good banking relationship is critical. And actually, what I'd like to say is this should not come as a surprise to Americans at all.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it. C.K. Prahalad, professor at the University of Michigan Business School and now the author of The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, published by the Wharton School Publishing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.